You're listening to the NarniWeb.com podcast, and I'm your host, Rillian. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. This is Rillian again, after a brief hiatus. It's been almost a month, and we're finally back doing the NarniaWeb.com podcast. So today, Glumpel and I are going to be discussing our thoughts about the character development with Prince Caspian and the other Telmarines and the old Narnians. So we have Glumpel here, and let's begin. And hello, Glumpel. Welcome back.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Can you hear me out there?
Yes, I can hear you out here.
Okay, for the first time, we're in... like completely, well, we've done different time zones all the time, but like a completely different time zone.
Yes, indeed. It is 8:28 p.m. right here where I am.
And it is 3:28 p.m. right here.
Yes, and it's taken quite a bit of time for me because I moved to a completely different area. So it's been a little unusual, and it's taken me a while to get our podcast up and running. But now we are up and running.
Because where are you, Rillian?
I am studying at Oxford University this term. I will be at New College, and I'll be here for a full term.
And got to actually visit the pub.
Yes.
The pub.
Yes. I got to visit the C.S. Lewis, the Bird and Baby, or formerly called the Eagle and Child. But my friends and I had lunch there the other day, and there's also the Lemon Flag. And apparently the owner of the Bird and Baby made a big mistake by changing the wallpaper color without asking for Lewis's permission, and so he was so upset that he moved to the Lemon Flag pub, which is just across the street. And I think my roommate and I are going to try a pint over there sometime, yeah.
So perhaps you got to sit in the spot where, I mean, who knows what ideas might possibly have come to Lewis's mind, you know?
Well, I don't know about sitting in that seat. I'm pretty sure he sat in another part of the pub, but I'm pretty sure I felt the flow of Narnian energy and karma. No, just kidding.
Yeah. Okay. So after, how long has it been? It's been,
I don't know, 2.5 weeks?
It was like longer.
Yeah.
But all right.
I don't know. I am in a later time zone, so
that's true.
It feels
that's
like
true.
A time warp.
So time kind of seems different. But so the next part, last part of the character analysis. And guess it makes sense to start with Prince Caspian himself.
Prince Caspian. Yeah, all right. So let's start off with you. You know, what are your thoughts about Prince Caspian? Mm-hmm. And you know, I know you got to meet Ben Barnes as well. And I know that you said that encouraged you when you met him and how he would portray the character.
Yeah. Obviously, the big issue from the beginning with Caspian was the fact that Ben Barnes is 25 and Caspian is only 13 in the book. And which seemed weird. I mean, I think most people kind of admitted that, well, you know, William Moseley and all the actors have aged. It doesn't make sense to have Caspian be almost the same age as Lucy when he should be closer to Peter's age. And but people were wondering, well, can Ben Barnes even play 17? He does look so old. And when I saw him in Prague, I felt better because, you know, it was the first time I'd seen anything of him besides like an IMDb photo, and I felt a lot better after that, after seeing him in costume and everything.
Yeah, well, I think that now I don't want to fault the actor for maybe something that the script did, but I mm-hmm. think that he did okay. I don't think he was great. I don't think that he really. I think it was fair, but I mean, I don't think he really captured the energy that I perceived the character as having. And he's a little older than I would have liked, and I know I can't really... It's not his fault he was born at that time. But I think that the Caspian in the book had an
yeah.
energy about him of learning and discovering new things. And even in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, which I'm reading... the only pleasure book I was able to bring, because I have this huge stack of books to read here at Oxford, is Voyage of the Dawn Treader. But even reading that, there's an energy there and an excitement, which I mm-hmm. didn't feel that Ben Barnes brought. And maybe he'll bring that forward more in Voyage of the Dawn Treader. But I don't know.
the reason for that, or probably a big reason for that, is the fact that they had to cut out so much of his early childhood, which is where you get a lot of that excitement.
True. Yeah, that's
which we talked. I think we kind of talked about in past episodes why I think that was probably a terrible but necessary change, perhaps. But yeah, you don't get to see, which is such an important part of the book thematically, is Caspian's hope that the old days and his excitement that they're actually real, that the myth is becoming fact.
Discovering it's not a myth.
And so they definitely, I thought, lost that. Although I kind of agree with you. I thought Ben Barnes, he did a fine job. It didn't blow me away, but I think he got the job done. He did what he needed to do. And, you know, so I did a fine job with it. I thought it was interesting that for a change, I felt like he wasn't the reluctant hero as much as I thought he was going to be. So with Peter, that was what I didn't like about him in the first movie. And this one, I thought, like, Caspian, like, he was going... Now, this is how I understand it, that he was going to meet the old Narnians. Whoa, hang on a second. Hang on a second. Is that how you interpreted that scene?
Oh, which scene when in particular?
When they're... it's just before they meet Reepy Cheep, where they're...
Yeah, I think so.
And, you know... And, you know, like, the Minotaurs, they're real, that thing. I thought Caspian was on his way to convince them, and they were like, hang on a second, slow down, one step at a time here.
Well, yeah, because he says, well, don't you understand what this is, pointing to the horn. So I think, you know, once he understood that part, he was going to, yeah, I think that's the same
idea. Yeah, I like
idea.
The idea, and because of the fact that he's been raised as a prince. So I enjoyed, for once, seeing a hero who was perhaps not reluctant enough, in a sense. And then by the end, he kind of, It's weird. It's the opposite. A reluctant hero by the end of the story, feeling like he's not ready. And so I really liked that.
Yeah, I think in that respect, you're right. What's funny is that at first we thought that he was going to come across as being very, very cocky. And I didn't see them playing that up too much.
Not really, no.
I think that was the word they used, though.
The word that they used. That was the word that the spy report used. Yeah, he said Caspian seemed cocky. Those were the early reports we got about the character. And he was a prince, you know? Not necessarily cocky, but kind of confident in himself being a prince and everything.
Yeah, and being a prince who's in his late 20s or mid-20s, it's not really... he doesn't look young enough to really be that vulnerable. I know he's playing a 17-year-old.
He does.
He does look about the same, a little older than Peter.
Yeah, he definitely does look, if anything I have to say, he does definitely does look older than Peter. And I definitely would have liked Ben Barnes if he was younger. That would definitely have been a lot better. But I think he plays the part just fine, and ultimately that's the priority.
Yes, and I don't want to be too hard on the character. I feel like he was kind of breaking into the role, and at times I felt he didn't quite know what to do. But I think he will probably do better than in Voyage of the Dawn Treader. I'm hoping.
Yeah, there were a couple times where actually where I was thinking that Ben Barnes reminded me more of how I thought of Caspian in Voyage of the Dawn Treader. And so I'll be looking forward to seeing him in Dawn Treader. And hopefully they'll pull back the accent a little bit, I would hope.
I am Prince Caspian. No, I am
Prince
Caspian.
Right, which you could kind of justify. Probably in 3 years he wouldn't lose it. His accent wouldn't really be affected by being around the Narnians. But I think for the purposes of storytelling, if they wanted to pull back his accent a little bit, I think they could get away with it.
Yes, agreed.
And there was another character issue I wanted to go into, which was the White Witch. A lot of us, I think, well, I was definitely really afraid of it. Appeared in previews that Caspian was going along with the Narnians' plan to bring the White Witch back, which seemed totally out of character in the book. You know, as he realizes that they're suggesting bringing back the witch, I mean, you know, the hag, the werewolf, and Nickerick end up dead pretty quick.
And what's funny is that scene didn't turn out to be nearly as big an issue as everyone thought it was going to be.
No.
People thought it was going to be the
end
of the world.
And that was something where I was completely panicking.
It was going to be a huge issue.
Now, ultimately, you know, I've talked about this, and I won't really go into in detail here, but ultimately it wasn't an adaptation issue so much as it was, as a standalone film, the scene. I thought, like, it didn't really feel like it belonged in the movie.
I was one of the few who was saying, hey, guys, the Earth isn't going to end here. It's not the end of Narnia.
Yeah, and as it turned out, really, and I think probably if they were just making a movie, they would have had him kind of going along with it more, because they don't want to do something that would be so against the character in the book. They basically force him into it. They even cut his hand when he doesn't really want to. Although I feel like if he was really resisting, he probably could have gotten out of it. Like, no, you know, and that's the best he can do.
But, like Luke Skywalker, no, no.
Right.
Well, let's see. Who is the next character on our list?
Miraz, perhaps?
Yeah, Miraz would be good. Go ahead and discuss Miraz.
We don't really see a lot of Miraz in the book, very little of him, and they really expanded upon his role. What did you think of how they really did a lot more with Miraz than in the book?
I think that I liked it. Overall, I felt like it added a new ominous layer to the character, made him seem a little more imposing. But I didn't feel like it added quite as much as I don't know, I felt it could have. Like the scene with the guy, the troops, he says, how many men did you lose? I thought it was interesting, but in the end, I didn't really feel like it added a whole lot to the movie. I did think it, there's some moments I really liked. I liked little parts like his entrance into the movie where you don't really see his face. He's looking up at the stars. And I think some parts, though, just didn't add that much. I mean, it was kind of give and take for me. Some parts I liked how he had a new layer of character because, he comes across as being a little more intelligent than he did in the book.
I guess it's just because you don't see that much of him. The few times you do see him, like when he was being tricked into accepting the challenge, are cases where,
fair enough,
of course he's going to come across that way. But, I mean, he's been able to sort of manipulate and cheat his way to the throne, so he must be kind of an intelligent guy to be able to manipulate the system that way.
But even in the movie, he was one of the first ones to realize, oh, the old Narnians are real. Whereas, in the book, it seems like he's one of the last ones to finally get it. Hey, these kings and queens are real.
Well, see, as far as what we see, I think in the book it's definitely implied that Miraz deep down kind of believes that the Narnians are real, but just doesn't want to believe it. He just wants to push it out of his mind and ignore it. Maybe even kind of feels like if he just ignores it, it'll go away. and I thought for the most part that kind of came across in the movie, that ultimately that his public position is determined by what he wants to accomplish. If it'll help him get ahead politically, then that's what he's going to do. And I really like the fact that, like, in the scene in the book that got cut from the movie where Dr. Cornelius explains how Miraz cheated his way to the throne, and of course, where he mentions the seven lords that we see in Dawn Treader. That was a part of the book that always really interested me. And so I thought it was really cool that they actually visualized it for the movie, that they actually – it is a change from the book a little bit, but I just simply view it as they took that little speech by Cornelius, and you get to actually see him usurp the throne. And so that's – I thought that was really great. I thought all the Miraz additions were some of my favorite stuff in the whole movie. I was really happy with them.
Yeah, well, I don't think that there was a better actor out there than Sergio Castellano. I think he was absolutely perfect.
It was fantastic,
and
I thought. It could
– maybe it was because I didn't see the movie, but – I did not at all think of Leonidas from 300 when I saw it.
Not as I was watching it, but definitely if you compare the still photographs, definitely has that look.
This is
it almost looks like they were. Yeah, it almost looks like they were trying. But
how many of your action figures did you bring? I have to ask.
Narnia, all I brought was Caspian. By the way, everybody, I'm at college too now.
Yeah, he's at college.
All I brought was Caspian and Miraz. All I brought of Narnia. And Aslan.
Oh, naturally, you have to bring Aslan.
Right.
Of course. All right, well, what's the next
one more
character?
Issue I wanted to just discuss.
Oh, one
the
more
scene
issue.
Where – right, we discussed
– there's always one more issue.
We discussed the scene, endlessly about where he's tricked into accepting the challenge. I just really like the fact that ultimately it was – just like in the book, it was Miraz's own pride that kind of brought him down, that they tricked him into like, well, I'm not a coward, and the thought that scene was – and then the scene where Caspian spares Miraz, and then Miraz telling Caspian, you might make a great Telmarine King after all. I thought that was really – it's a great way to make the statement that the old ways are gone, that the ways of Miraz are passing away and Caspian's going to be a different king, the return of the old ways, which is an important theme in the story. Mm-hmm. So really like
– Yeah.
So
who's next?
Glizelle and Sepespian we could talk about briefly.
Oh, yes, briefly. Let's talk about them.
And Glizelle, both those characters, they did a lot more with it in the book. They only have, one or two scenes in the book. And they're introduced
really
very
scene.
Late. And I thought Glizelle, first of all, Pier Francesco Favino was so under the radar. It wasn't even really thinking about him. I thought he delivered one of the best performances in the movie, and I liked what they did with the character, giving him a journey to where he had is kind of turns against Miraz.
Yeah, and for a while, I was really wondering. I mean, I could kind of tell they were going to do something like this, with one being more loyal than the other. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't really see who is more loyal, Glazelle or is it Zepespian? Because mm-hmm. it was sort of ambiguous to me, because you know, at one point you have Glazelle saying, well, those are dangerous words, Lord Zepespian.
Right.
And then Zepespian, of course, is the one who stabs Miraz.
Yeah. And Zepespian, it was interesting, of course, you know, Glazelle, Zepespian ultimately just wants the throne. Mm-hmm. As it turns out. And Glazelle, I think, ends up being more sympathetic towards the Narnians.
Yeah.
And it was cool how they kind of gave Zepespian that role of wanting to steal the throne.
Yeah, it's like Glazelle has a better understanding of loyalty, and yeah. even if it's misplaced. But Zepespian, it's all for his personal gain. You know, once Miraz is dead, you know, it's very
yeah. Yeah. And going back to that scene where Caspian spares Miraz, I think there's a couple shots where it just flashes real quickly to Glazelle and Sepespian's reactions. And I got the sense that they were watching Caspian and they were really impressed and kind of surprised by the fact that he spared them. And that was really important.
I didn't notice that.
But by the fact that that's really important, the fact that they were – that's kind of an idea in the book that they kind of expect the Narnians to be these vicious, you know, bad guys. And the fact that – you know, I liked in the movie the fact that Caspian shows mercy – surprises and it impresses them. Or I think Glazelle is impressed. Sepespian's kind of annoyed, like, I guess I gotta kill him now.
Yeah, well, it's not at all an accident. I don't think that once Miraz is dead, Sepespian is the first one to grab the sword and start leading the troops.
Yeah, that's the running sort of...
You can see that.
Sort of a running image throughout the story of someone passing on the sword to another, in Sepespian's case, forcibly taking the sword.
Well, it's usurping, which is the same thing that Miraz did.
Exactly. So, moving on.
Moving on, let's discuss Dr. Cornelius next.
Sounds good.
Yeah, well, Dr. Cornelius is certainly one of the more interesting of the Prince Caspian characters.
Mm-hmm. And he also, I guess as far as, he had a very different role, in a sense, than he did in the book. You know, in the book, before they even go to Aslan's Howl, Cornelius, he finds them. And here, I guess one of the... Well, one of Caspian's motivations behind it kind of takes the role of nurse in a sense.
Sort of.
In a way, not really, but and then how kind of one of Caspian's ideas behind the night raid is to rescue him. And he, of course, encourages Caspian after the night raid. Mm-hmm. And
Now remind me, at what point do you discover that he's part dwarf in the movie?
That's after the night raid when he says, you know, my mother was a black dwarf from the Northern Mountains.
Oh, that's right.
And that's when, and there's all that. You know, of course, he has that great line, that you have the chance to be the most noble contradiction in history. The Telmarine.
Yeah, well, that is a good
line. To save Narnia.
Yeah, and I think this brings about one of the interesting points just about the Narnian Chronicles, if I may. You know, that you know, I think, oh, really, who's been another contradiction like this? Oh, no, wait, Narnia has its own history. And it kind of, it's a little remind you that, you know, these people have their own historians, their own chroniclers, and interesting stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to think about because sometimes Lewis will say, oh, you know, if I ever hear about this story, maybe I'll write that one down too, you know.
And Vincent Grass, I thought he was great. It wasn't really the way I imagined Dr. Cornelius, I guess because I still have that the late Pauline Baynes image in my head. So.
I think I imagine him to be a little less noble, more less regal looking.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Although I like the glasses, though. But I thought that Vincent Grass, I liked his voice. It's such a shame that we got to miss the whole idea of him being a storyteller. That they reference it with, you know, Caspian saying, oh, it was my professor that told me stories. But it would have been nice to see that.
Yeah, that's true. And he's in the film really very little. But one of my favorite bits with him was the bit, like it's the noble contradiction of history part where, you know, he's with Caspian.
Yeah.
At least you get that little bit there. And it was a good little scene, but it's a shame that he's in there so little.
So we can move on to Truffle Hunter?
Truffle Hunter, yes. Alas, one of my big regrets about the character in the movie is that he is not in the Sorcery and Sudden Vengeance scene, because that's the scene in the book where you really get to see his loyalty. But I don't know why he wasn't really in that scene. It's one of his... You know, when you see him standing fast by the old Narnians, and I know he does it to a degree but in the movie, but... It's just you miss out on so much of the character when you don't have that scene.
I thought that Truffle Hunter possibly, I haven't really thought about it, but possibly more than any other character, I think, had a lot of lines from the book.
Well, and
just off the top of my head,
yeah, but
almost everything he said is like some root in the book.
Yeah, but it's not just the words, it's the actions of the character. And the fact that he wasn't in the scene fighting, and you know, he kind of disappears out of the movie for a little bit. And then you see him later in the battle. You go, oh, well, there he is. That's right. He's still around. He's still there.
And you know, like his role in the book, like you were kind of talking about, is that he's one of the few characters who believes in the old stories, just front, absolutely all the way through. And that came across.
And I think it comes through to a point.
And it's interesting that they kind of put it in a different context, but when that scene again, when just before they meet Reaper Chief, where they're walking through the forest and he's talking to Caspian, and he tells, you know, Caspian wants to go ahead and talk to the Ulnarians, and Tuffalanar's like, I just think we should wait for the kings and queens, That is in the book. He does want to, after they blow the horn, he does want to wait for the kings and queens, and so the context is very different, but to the very end, Tuffalanar's totally faithful.
But the change in the context of the story makes it not as strong.
A little bit, yeah.
Well, I think still think he's a good character in the film, but I don't think he's just not one of my favorites like he was in the book.
I was really happy with Truffle. I mean, it wasn't exactly how I imagined him in the book, but I thought the voice was very well cast. It, for a CG character in a movie, I thought it worked very well, even though it's not quite how I imagined Truffle Hunter. And the animation, I thought, was also...
Well, the voice was good, but... okay. I just didn't enjoy it as much. I just didn't really think they nailed the character so much.
Yeah, they didn't have the suspense of are the kings and queens gonna return? And towards the end, Truffle Hunter's starting to look kind of dumb, probably, to the Ulnarians of why are you still believing in this? Which Nick and Brickop points out.
Well, who's next?
We could do what we talk about Nick and Brick. What we're talking about him.
Oh, good, Nick and Brick.
And of course, we're Truffle Hunter. Is sort of the person who's completely faithful and believes in the old stories totally. Nicky Brick's somewhere in the middle, where he's skeptical, but like he says in the book, he's willing to put them to the trial. And I think that pretty much came across, and I guess they didn't really go into it so much, but he obviously, they established through Dancing Long that he believes the White Witch existed, and even suggests that maybe he might be okay with calling her back. And so I guess they didn't really go into it so much.
Yeah, well, I've said before that if I had been the casting director for Prince Caspian, I would have cast Peter Dinklage as Nicabrick, and I would have cast Warwick Davis as Trumpkin. But I really didn't anticipate how he would do the character, but it really works out well, I think. And I think that the fact, you know, he's able to play him as a very... I could say human, I could say dwarfish character as well. But I think that playing him as a sympathetic character was definitely a good decision, because in the book, when I was, at least the first time I read it, when I was little, and Caspian says, well, he might have lived to be a good dwarf if we won quicker. And I remember thinking, come on, Caspian, you're such a bad judge of character. He's a bad dwarf, he tried to kill you, you know. But I think that here you can definitely say, yes, he was evil, but... And yet, had it been an easier road and a quicker one, then maybe he would have been a better dwarf.
I completely disagree. We talked about this before. I always got the impression with Nicky Brick that like something bad had happened to him, and he was always paranoid, suspicious of the outside world. And I definitely felt like if they'd won quickly, like he would have turned out to be a nice guy. It was just worth seeing him in a very extreme situation.
Well, as I was saying, that was my first response when I first heard it, or when I was little. But I really think that Warwick Davis nailed the character. I think he, of course, he was a little funnier in this, had some funnier lines, but he was also very sinister. And at times, he almost seemed more reasonable than Trumpkin.
And, of course, a lot of that sympathy by the end of the movie, I think, comes from the fact that when, you know, he kind of has a little scuffle with Lucy, and right, he's about to kill her, then he...
That's right. And then he pauses.
But, yeah, because he's about to kill Lucy, but then... Nick kind of hesitates, like he's not sure, and that's when that kind of makes you feel bad when he dies. And so I think that's where a lot of that sympathy came from. But then I guess we should move on to Trumpkin while we're talking about it.
Yes, good transition to Trumpkin. Yeah. All right, brilliant transition.
But Trumpkin, it's definitely different. He doesn't quite have the sort of sense of humor that I got from Trumpkin in the book. And not as much, as much more sarcastic.
Well, you do get it, but it's
yeah,
this
much a lot more
humor.
Sarcastic, which seems appropriate for the character. Like when the trees, what do you expect? You know, it seems kind of appropriate. Although we I guess we've already kind of talked about how it's the movie's not very clear on what does Trumpkin believe. Does he believe that the stories? Does he believe they're true? But they're all extinct now. I mean, it's a little bit unclear. Although I would tend to lean in the direction that he thinks that. The stories were true, and now but now they're all gone, and Aslan's abandoned, and that's kind of what he seems to believe in the movie, which is different. But overall, Trumpkin was different than how I imagined him in the book. But there's enough of Trumpkin there, and the fact that cinematically, I think it's just a great character that I was happy with Peter Dinklage overall.
Yeah, well, I think he was able to take the character and take what could have been a sort of two-dimensional character, really make him a very round, well-developed character. And you have moments where he certainly, you know, saying, oh yeah, he's just this dry, sarcastic stick in the mud. But you had moments like the moment at Aslan's How where he tells Susan, he says, haven't enough of us already died? And,
oh yeah.
And little moments like that. And the moment at the end where he says goodbye to Lucy. And it's little bits like that remind you, yes, he's, you know, this is this tough little character, but he's got this soft side to him as well.
Yeah, and it's important, of course, that Trumpkin thinks the plan is ridiculous. Which it's, at this point in the story, it's kind of complicated the way they restructured it. But basically, what this point in the story I think is supposed to kind of parallel is the part of the book where they're debating should we, you know, where they ultimately decide to blow the horn. And in this scene, they ultimately decide to send Lucy out to find Aslan or whatever it is she's hoping to do. But we've talked about. Right. But then Trumpkin, of course, thinks the plan's ridiculous, you know, just like he does in the book.
And, of course, the part where he says goodbye to Lucy. I love that part. I cry.
Yeah.
No.
And, of course, they said they got DLF in there. They said Dear Little Friend a couple times, actually.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't know if we mentioned this, but that's our new t-shirt.
That's right.
DLF.
Dear Little Fanatic.
Which you,
because it's my rival colors. Oh, well, I'll find
colors.
A way to dye it or something. I don't know.
Yes, your rival colors.
I'll just write like Dear Little Gator Fanatic or something like
gator.
That. No. But,
but
yeah, like it.
No.
But yeah, I was pretty happy with Trumpkin.
Yeah.
And you know, there are a couple scenes where Trumpkin is in the same scene as Glenstorm. Oh, speaking of Glenstorm.
Transition.
I just want to briefly mention Glenstorm because he's one of my favorite secondary characters in the book. And I thought the whole star, like, when I saw who they cast for him, I thought he'd do a good job, and the whole Stargazer thing seemed to fit really well. Although I wish they'd made him seem older and wiser rather than this tough military guy who happens to be a Stargazer at the same time. Although he also had a couple lines from the book that I really liked. The time is ripe, I watch the skies and all that.
I think that had they, you know, maybe just included a shot or two of him looking up at the stars, and the stars reflected in his eyes. It's just that in the book you don't have him, you know. And then Glenstorm hit a soldier and threw him up 15 feet in the air. You get the Stargazer part.
I would have liked to have seen that, like, old wise centaur, this ancient wise centaur, more than like when they gave him the armor and everything. It wasn't really Glenstorm to me anymore.
Well, he didn't have armor in the movie. I don't think he did.
Well, whatever you call it, those like the X thing he has, you know, across his. What do you call it?
Sword
those
straps.
Strap things, you know?
I don't know. Belts? Something you attach a sword frog to? I don't know.
I don't know what we call it. I mean, it's got to go two of them going across the chest.
Yeah, well, I thought he did a good job. I mean, I thought he captured the.
I like the Baronorius.
Yes. Well, I am amazed at how. You know, people compare special effects between these fantasy movies, but I think that in terms of comparing Harry Potter to Narnia, Narnia is definitely taking the gold in how to do centaurs.
Oh my! Absolutely, Narnia is
definitely beautiful.
The best, I think, the best movie centaurs ever done. Period.
Yeah.
Harry Potter's had two chances to do centaurs, and they've blown it twice.
Yes.
And I just think it's because centaurs, you can do it. You can make them look really cool and really realistic, but it takes a lot of time, a lot of effort. to make it work.
You have to
and
be creative,
I think
too.
Andrew Adamson has been the only person so far who was willing to take the time, effort, and money to make a believable movie centaur. And they look even better in this one than in Wardrobe, which is amazing.
Yeah, well, like even the battle scene, you know, they had like the one where the centaur jumps over the camera. Yeah, it's a horse, real horse, and then it's a fake centaur torso.
And even in Prince Caspian, they somehow improved upon it. Where like you see this one, you actually see centaurs running like full speed right past the camera in a lot of cases.
Yeah, and then they rear up, and you know, I don't know how they did that.
Like, what did? Did they like have him on wires and like lift him up? I mean, I really want to know how, like when he like kind of rears up before the Knight Rider. I really want to know how they did that shot. That was really impressive.
Yeah, but we'll probably hear about it in the commentary or something like that. So. Anyway.
So, have we forgotten anybody? Huh?
Oh, boy. I don't know. Have we forgotten anyone? Maybe small character?
Small character, possibly.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe, but or maybe a large character. Maybe it's a big character.
Yes, it's the biggest small character.
No.
In Narnia.
No, he's the smallest big character in Narnia.
So, you can go first. How did you think of how they portrayed, you know, who? Not Voldemort.
I think that they really nailed Reaper 2. I can't think of anything that they didn't well on. But I did find one review that was negative, and I found one on the internet. It does exist.
Yeah.
And I think it's the part where, you know, they said, "Oh, he says shut up," you know, to Peepy Cheek, and they said, to the Powder Twig. And I think they said, "Oh, he would have never done that in the book." And I'm thinking, come on, but it's so funny.
Maybe, yeah. Reaper Cheek probably would not have said shut up. But I think I just love the idea so much of Powder Twig and Reaper Cheek, those completely different characters.
Well, I think that the best moment is the part where he meets Lucy. And he says,
"Who said that?"
Yeah, well, after that, he says, "I believe that with the utmost respect, I believe that courteous, chivalrous, or courageous is more descriptive of a knight of Narnia." You know, it just sounds just like Lewis.
That was extremely. It obviously, I think, was supposed to be, you know, kind of inspired by Don Shredder, where Lucy wants to cuddle him but knows it would offend him.
Yes, well, you can tell the writers that, okay, we need to find a line for this scene. It needs to sound just like the book, because this is one of his introduction here. We need to get a line and find some line and tweak it a little bit so we can mold it here, so it will resonate with the fans, you know?
Yeah. Although, Reaper Cheek, he has very few lines from the book, actually.
I wish that he'd had that terrific line that he says to Peter.
"Life is ever your command, my honor is my own."
Yes, exactly, that line.
Yeah, of course, they cut out that whole scene for various reasons, which you don't have time to go into here, so maybe there wasn't really a place for it. But, so I hope they find a way to squeeze that into Don Shredder, because that line just says Reaper Cheek so well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I'd say he was probably the best.
Yeah, I think he was the best, my favorite character in the movie, and also the best CG character.
Yeah, I don't think he actually looked. He did look a little bit fakey to me, but the way the performance, I thought, was very convincing. It gave me a sense of weight, especially when the mice were running through the night raid, which I love that part of the night. It's my favorite part of the night raid. I thought it really gave you the sense of weight, and I really liked it. But going back to – what was I talking about before? Oh, with the lines from the book, he says – he has very few lines he actually says in the book, which is a shame, of course, because he's probably the most quotable character in the entire series. And yet the lines they came up – the lines they came up with Reaper Cheek were also very memorable and very funny and the kinds of things that I can absolutely see Reaper Cheek saying. And that's one of the reasons why he's such a great example of adaptation of not a lot of the lines from the book, but a lot of memorable lines at the same time.
And I would also venture to say that he's probably has the best introduction to any of the characters in the film, maybe even both films.
I'd agree.
Yeah, I think that it was just terrific. It was funny. It was entertaining. It was exciting. And he had a great line.
Introduction for the character. It's not in the book, though. In the book, of course, it's just, oh, and they met Reaper Cheek. You know, they don't really make a big deal about it.
Yeah.
But it was a great way to, since he's become such a beloved character, it seemed appropriate to come up with something more. And it was great they had the scene where he gets his tail back. Nice.
Mm-hmm.
They had it in there.
So
and, of course, they kind of at the end, he kind of talks about, it'll be a reminder of my huge humility, kind of tying it into one of the themes of the story. But you'll have to. I refuse to believe a negative review from it exists until you'll have to show it to me before I believe it. Because all the reviews that I read, like even those negative ones, oh, but that mouse is kind of cool.
I'll
they have something cool to say about. Everyone, all my friends thought he was neat. And so.
Well, it does exist. And Bigfoot and Nessie exist as well. But I have a friend who hated the idea. She was predetermined to hate Prince Caspian and hate. She didn't like Eddie Izzard, so she didn't want to like Reepy Jeep. And then, of course, once she saw the movie, I said, "So, what do you think of Reepy Jeep?" And she said, "She said, oh, I love Reepy Jeep."
Eddie Izzard was just perfect, and I'm proud to be one of the people who supported him from day one. I voted "I'm ecstatic" in the poll when he was announced. Thought he was complete. Brilliant.
Yes, well, I don't have your gift of prophecy.
Another voice coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I admit I did not have the faith that you did. I confess. I'm not ashamed.
True.
But at least I didn't freak out over the white witch and the ice block. And.
But I would say that Reepy Cheep is probably the best thing. If I had to pick one thing in the film, like that's the best part of the film, I'd have to go with Reepy Cheep. It really makes a lot of some of the changes I don't like. It makes them even easier to bear because, they made some annoying changes, but regardless, they nailed perhaps one of the most beloved characters in children's literature.
And it carries
on to
the next film.
Absolutely nailed him. I can't think of another actor's voice coming from that character. The animation was beautiful. It was so in the spirit of the character. And that's so satisfying as a Narnia fan.
Yeah. Well, I have this vision of Andrew Adamson sitting in his parlor going, if I don't know the Reepy Cheep, then I'll know that Glumbuddle's going to go and kill me and I'll be killed and hanged and lynched and stuff. You know,
if I just nail Reepy Cheep, maybe the kiss will be okay. Maybe that's what you'll see.
I was thinking, maybe this one episode we'll get through a discussion of Prince Caspian without the kiss coming up. But no, you had to ruin it.
Never going to happen. But I'll never forgive that. Well,
no,
Reepy Cheep makes it a little bit easier. And, of course, then there was the issue of, which I was determined to make it an issue, actually, of his fur, which turned out to not be a big deal.
No,
and there is a picture in the official companion, shows I'm not crazy, of the stand-in white Reepy Cheep, life-size stand-in white, completely white. I'm talking pinky in the brain here. Completely lab rat white. And I freaked out and said, okay, maybe pure black isn't going to, even though I love the black so much, maybe pure black isn't going to work as well cinematically. But come on, you can't make him white. That's crazy. And I'm just happy to say that it looked nothing like what I saw on set. Yeah. So I was very happy with the design of Reepy Cheep.
Well, I am glad that we have proof you're not crazy. And I'm glad for your sake and for mine that it was not white. Otherwise, I would have never heard the end of
right.
it. So.
But, oh my gosh, We do have to kind of stop now, but we go on forever. But there are so many things about Reepy Cheep I could go into.
Yeah, well, this was a good episode, and probably in the next episode we're going to talk about something that Fantasia Kitty actually started up a thread in the forum called What Went Wrong and why the movie wasn't as successful as we had hoped. So we might be talking about that, and then we'll segue into Voyage of the Dawn Treader eventually.
So will this kind of wrap up our Prince Caspian discussion for the most part?
Yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm. That's the idea. And,
Starts shooting in January. So just a few more months.
Voyage of the Dawn Treader starts in January. I can't believe it.
Farewell.
It is looming.
It's been epic.
Yes, thank you very much, Glumbuddle. It was fun. It's been too long.
That was cool.
Cheers. Thank you very much for joining us. If you want to email us with thoughts or comments, you can email me, leon@narniaweb.com, and you can also email glumbuddle@narniaweb.com. And as always, there's the iTunes Music Store, and there's the comments on the website, narniaweb.com, if you want to just post feedback and don't necessarily need an answer to your question. Thank you for listening, and until next time, I'm your host, Rillian.